There's a group that's become, in many ways, the Paul Revere of the anti-globalization movement, and it's called the Third World Network. They told us about the World Trade Organization before anybody had heard. Yao Graham is the director of Third World Network Africa. He is a longtime opponent of structural adjustment programs and indeed has served prison time in his native Ghana for his opposition to the implementation of a particularly brutal structural adjustment program. He's also led in the formation of African networks on trade and on development and on economic policy. Please welcome Yao Graham.
Good evening to you all. I think the point Bill made at the end of his presentation and also at the start about the importance of mainstreaming this international struggle into our national politics is extremely important. I want to underline that because coming from Ghana, which at the moment is a symbol for those who see the new imperialism as a way forward, a country which is an important cog in the push of neoliberal economics, a country which has become an example which is held up by those who falsely claim that a neoliberal model is working. It is important for those of us who struggle together globally to also deepen our struggles at the national level. And I think what US citizens can do in the heartland of the most powerful pillar of the new imperialism is, needless to say, of great strategic significance for all of us. So for that, I think I'm very pleased to join you here this evening as part of the mobilization against the coming IMF World Bank meetings. Because, as you all know, Africa is the site of the largest collection of countries which are undergoing structural adjustment. If the way the IMF treated the Asian financial crisis could be compared to carpet bombing, what the IMF has been doing in Africa has been a long war of attrition. The effects, of course, are the same, whether it's carpet bombing or it's a war of attrition. The financial crisis that engulfed Southeast Asia has been well spoken about. Of course, Africa is not part of the mainstream of the emerging markets. Only a few countries in that continent are considered sufficiently robust in terms of their financial sector to be part of the global financial system in terms of, say, active movement or speculative capital. But having said that, Africa was also caught up in the waves that came out of the Asian financial crisis. And in that sense, the impact of the financial crisis fed what I would like to describe as a long-standing casino of the global commodities market. In a certain sense, the current struggle to get some regulation of international capital movements is very similar to what developing countries struggled for in the 60s and 70s in terms of trying to stabilize commodity prices. Because commodities have been long subject to speculation. Currently, in most African countries, after years of embracing structural adjustment and accepting the claim that export-driven growth will be the way forward, once again, a crash in commodity prices has left many economies in crisis, or should I say worsened the crisis of these economies, so that the casino economy at the world level operates in diverse ways. In some places, is in terms of, say, the quick movement of speculative capital in and out. In some places, it is a sudden drop in commodity prices. Speculators, of course, make money. But countries whose lives depend on commodity earnings are suddenly left with shortfalls in income. And in the countryside, peasants whose livelihoods depend on these incomes have their lives devastated. The situation has been made worse in quite a number of countries because under the aegis of the IMF World Bank policies, marketing boards have been removed. One unspoken factor in the recent coup d'etat in Côte d'Ivoire was the fact that the long-standing marketing board for cocoa in that country and coffee were dismantled on the orders of the IMF and World Bank. So the protection that farmers enjoyed of a stable domestic price, something which is available by way of, say, subsidies for farmers in the big industrial countries, was no longer available for these farmers. Cocoa prices crashed. Farmers actually took to cutting down their farms, but the cocoa was not worth harvesting. This was the context of social turmoil, in addition, of course, to other things that made a coup d'etat possible. So when I read the reports about how suddenly, in the Western press, that is, that suddenly from nowhere, a model of stability and economic growth in Africa has suffered a coup d'etat with no reference to the contributions of these kinds of economic processes, once again, one found a lie being told. But I think I want to pick up this point about the roller coaster in a number of dimensions and link it a bit more clearly to the role of the IMF. Because the process of neoliberal economics in the African context has centered around increasing, as I said, the production of commodities for export. The collapse in prices leads to declining incomes. The declining incomes lead to domestic budgetary crisis, which generate their own pressure for further opening up because the countries are faced with increased indebtedness. The pressure to open up, of course, means greater liberalization. And greater liberalization means greater subjection to the conditionalities of the IMF and World Bank. In 1998, for example, Africa suffered a 17% drop in its export earnings, even as the volume of exports increased. In that same year, the continent's terms of trade declined by 13%. Now, this is in a context where very savage processes of liberalization had resulted in growth in the dependence on export commodities. But alongside this also, extreme liberalization of the investment regime had led to, at least in, say, mineral and extractive sector resource-endowed countries, to an influx of foreign direct investment. It is extremely disputable whether, in fact, these countries are making net gains from this inflow of foreign direct investment. Why do I say that? Because the liberalized terms mean that in almost all cases, the firms are protected from any tax for any period ranging up to 10 years. They can bring in a whole range of things duty-free with exemption. And also, the structure of the investment means that very few of them actually declare corporate profits to be subject to taxation. In Ghana, for example, which has the single largest concentration of open cast gold mines in its western region, a western region which also happens to be the only remaining area of high forest in the country, not a single mine which has operated there since the mid-70s has actually declared profit for tax purposes internally. But none of those mines has a life of more than 10 years. Most of them have an average life of about 6 years. So within 6 years, they are finished, no profits declared, and they are gone. When the price of gold declined, some of these firms were actually opened by firms which are engaged in speculation. They wanted to make quick money on, on, on gold prices. When the prices dropped, they shot and moved. Of course, the environmental legislation is very weak. So in addition to the destruction of the environment, there's also the question about there being not even any net material gain to a local economy. Local livelihoods were devastated, rivers polluted. You can take this story in any number of African countries, because if you look at the pattern of investment flow, which is meant to signal the success of, say, liberalization, you find that actually it has gone mainly into the extractive sector. And it is not creating jobs of any type. In the countries which have attempted to create, say, EPZs of the type that Bill was talking about, you find the replication of exactly the same conditions of workers working under very repressive conditions with job insecurity, with very poor pay. Despite this, of course, indebtedness has increased on the continent. You've been given some figures already, but just to repeat some of them. Despite the claim that adjustment and liberalization brings improvements, in 1990, the debt of Africa was $294 billion. In 1998, it was $342 billion. $342 billion. Of the 41 highly indebted countries listed by the IMF and World Bank, 33 African countries. Interestingly, Ghana, which is the longest-running adjustment show in Africa, which in every pamphlet, piece of paper put up by the IMF and World Bank, is a success story. The country's debt has grown from $1.2 billion in 1982, just before the start of adjustment, to over $6 billion as of 1999. In 1982, the country could not, by any stretch of the imagination, be described as a highly indebted, poor country. By 1999, in the year 2000, it is listed as such, despite the claim that it is a great success story for adjustment. And what has happened in the Ghanaian economy recently is very illustrative of the trends I'm talking about. With the collapse of cocoa and gold prices, everything crashed. Late in 1999, it became official. The IMF, the World Bank, everybody agreed that the thing was in crisis. The value of the Ghanaian cedi, which was about 2,000 to the US dollar about a year ago, is now 4,000 plus to the US dollar. Interestingly, precisely because of this crisis, the country, of course, has become more dependent on international, say, credit. One of the possibilities for getting more credit would be to accept the terms of the highly indebted poor countries' debt relief initiative. But the country is very dependent also on Japanese credit. Japan holds about 15% of Ghana's debt stock. And Japan, of course, is bitterly opposed to anything that smells of debt relief. So the Japanese say, take your pick. You get debt relief under HIPIC, you get no Japanese money. Now, the reason why this story is important is because it's supposed to be a model adjusting country which is successful. Only the extractive sector has attracted investment, and even that has been shown to be unsustainable. All it took was the drop in commodity prices and 17 years of structural adjustment, and the claims made for it has been exposed to be completely false. We could say this as indicative, as I said, of what is happening on the continent. And this is what makes it so important for us from the African continent, that the global movement against the role of the IMF and World Bank is deepening, and also more people are joining it. And that it is not simply a matter of solidarity, but also becoming a matter of concern in terms of how domestic politics in the major powers of the United States is played out. And I want to add that as we talk about the role of the IMF World Bank at the multilateral level and the need to make that a domestic political issue, there are domestic political issues of the same type which ought to be brought into the agenda. I'm talking here about the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which is a bilateral initiative by the United States to effectively create a transatlantic NAFTA. the claim made for the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act is that it represents a framework for increasing the benefits that African countries can get from capital flows from the United States. The Growth and Opportunity Act is not a Growth and Opportunity Act for Africa. It's a Growth and Opportunity Act for American capital. All the principles that we oppose within the programs of the IMF and World Bank are the core principles of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. Those countries that fulfill the destructive demands of the bank and the fund are the ones which are supposed to benefit from capital flows, are the ones in respect of which OPEC would give support to American investment. So in fact, the Growth and Opportunity Act is an attempt to get national benefit, very focused national benefit for American business from what the IMF went back, is able to clear the path for. And I'd like to urge you that in addition to the struggle against the IMF, World Bank, broadly speaking, right now before the Senate, the Growth and Opportunity Act is beginning to come back into the mainstream. Add the struggle against the Growth and Opportunity Act to the struggle against the IMF and World Bank, and that will be a very specific contribution to linking the international campaign with the national struggle. Thank you very much.
Miss Martin Kaur, but we welcome Yao Graham. Thank you for joining us. Our next speaker is a very hard person to introduce. Much of his work has been as a terrific researcher. He's written books. He's a terrific analyst. But I think most of us know him as one of the best organizers that North America has ever produced. And I think one of the reasons why Canada has emerged as an anti-globalization superpower is because of the work of Maude Barlow and our next speaker, Tony Clark. Tony first came onto our doorstep when the great presidents Bush and Salinas and Mulroney, Prime Minister of Canada, proposed something called the North American Free Trade Agreement. Tony created a model of organization, or help create a model of organization in Canada, an Action Canada network that pulled together segments of civil society. After the NAFTA fight, he and Maude and others helped transform this into a terrific engine of organizing against the Multilateral Agreement on Investments, a battle which they led and helped to win. It's terrific to work with him. He's now the head also of the Polaris Institute and the Corporations Committee of the International Forum on Globalization. Please welcome Tony Clark.
Thank you, John. I don't know what we would do. I don't know what to do with those kind of superlatives, and I don't know how other people respond either, but thank you very much. I would be remiss, however, in being in this building this evening, in this city, if we did not say, like the walls of Jericho in biblical times, the foundations of the American empire are shaking these days. We saw the fault lines opening up around the WTO in Seattle. And since last December, they've spread here, focusing in on the IMF in Washington. And I think I can say on behalf of everybody here this evening, wherever the global managers meet in the world, we, the representatives of civil society movements, will be there shaking the foundations one more time, one more time, one more time. And we know, as we gather with this panel here this evening, we know that the financial casino, where speculative rather than productive investments reign supreme, that this financial casino contains the fuel rods that fire the engines of corporate globalization. We have heard a great deal about the financial casino this evening, and we know that the electronic technology that allows currency traders to move around the world instantly, speculating on currencies and on commodity prices, that this is a major factor in the process. We also know that the rapid pace of financial deregulation that has been taking place all over the world in the last 10 years, where governments have surrendered their policy tools and the control that they have over the inflows and outflows of capital, is also a major factor. But when it comes to action, the question that is on our minds, I think, is what should be the major target? Should the major target be the IMF and the World Bank? Or are these the real engines of the global financial casino, or are there other engines that we should be focusing our agenda on as well? These are the kinds of questions I think that we need to wrestle with. This evening, I would like to bring back what John said earlier. I think he was right in saying that Bhagwati got it right on one thing, that we are dealing here fundamentally with a Wall Street Treasury complex. And of course, he was picking up on Eisenhower's military-industrial complex when he said this. But there is no question that what we are dealing with is that the driving forces behind the global financial casino today are really focused in on a very tight nexus that exists between the U.S. Treasury and Wall Street itself. And while Bhagwati didn't give us any great insights as to exactly how that system operates, I think it's important that we spend a little time trying to unpack it. The centerpiece of this engine, of course, are the world's money managers. They include the world's leading merchant and investment banks like Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Morgan Stanley, Deutsche Morgan Grenfell, Merrill Lynch, and Credit Suisse, First Boston, and a number of other big investment houses and speculators. It also includes that whole nexus of banks, whether we're talking about Citicorp and Chase Manhattan and Bank America, or Nations Bank and J.P. Morgan in this country, or Barclays and Deutsche Bank, or the Royal Bank of Canada, or the string of Tokyo-based banks in Japan. The fact is that these banks and investment houses, together they operate both as speculators and as creditors in global money markets. And through their speculative assaults, as Canadian economist Michelle Shevardnadze explains, they contribute to destabilizing national currencies and boosting the volume of dollar-dominated debts. Then they reappear as creditors with a view to collecting the debts. And finally, they are called in as policy advisors and consultants in the IMF World Bank-sponsored bankruptcy programs, of which they are the ultimate beneficiaries. In other words, the world's big money managers set countries on fire and then are called in as firemen to extinguish the blaze. Secondly, the U.S. Treasury essentially provides a financial safety net for these global money managers. Among the central banks of the G7 countries, the U.S. Treasury makes by far the largest lump sum contribution to the IMF-sponsored rescue operations. Now, this bailout money is not intended to, quote, rescue, unquote, countries facing bankruptcies at the hands of speculators who have taken a run at their currencies, but instead is earmarked to reimburse the commercial banks, investment houses, and brokerage firms which fueled the speculation in the first place. At the same time, the U.S. Treasury, and this is the case whether we're looking at Mexico in its $48 billion bailout, or Thailand with a $17 billion bailout, or Indonesia at $43 billion, or South Korea at $60 billion. We're talking about the same kind of scenario working itself out. At the same time, the U.S. Treasury serves the Wall Street money managers by forcing countries to open up their financial markets to foreign firms. And when, for example, the World Trade Organization was conducting negotiations on financial services and those negotiations broke down, the U.S. Treasury used the negotiations on bailout packages for several Asian countries as clout to force their governments to open up their financial markets to foreign banks and investment firms. Thirdly, the IMF, of course, as we all know, serves as the institutional vehicle for delivering this financial safety net. In collaboration with global money managers and speculators, the IMF ultimately decides not only what structural adjustment programs must be adopted by countries facing financial crisis as part of their rescue operations, but also which domestic enterprises are to be closed down, which ones must be auctioned off to foreign investors at bargain basement prices through fireside sales, and on and on and on. Moreover, the IMF's steadfast refusal to sanction any kind of capital controls by debtor countries as part of their monetary policy also serves the Wall Street financiers. As Bhagwati himself says, the absence of controls on the inflows and outflows of capital in a country's economy only enlarges the arena in which to make more money. Now, indeed, The Wall Street Treasury complex amounts to a vicious circle. For the most part, the IMF's multi-billion dollar bailout operations are not only financed through the U.S. Treasury and the other central banks of the G7 countries, but are mainly carried out by the issuing of public debt. In turn, the issuing of public debt by the U.S. Treasury Department to finance these bailouts tends to be underwritten and guaranteed by the same group of Wall Street merchant banks involved in the speculative assaults in the first place. Nice little convenient collusion, isn't it? As Shavadovsky points out, those who guarantee the issuing of public debt to finance these bailouts are those who will ultimately appropriate the loot. Meanwhile, the vast amounts of money provided through the IMF rescue packages enable recipient countries to meet their debt obligations with the same financial institutions that contributed to the breakdown of their national currencies in the first place. Now, let's just take one example, and that's South Korea. Prominent MIT economist Rudy Dornbusch revealed the U.S. agenda as far as South Korea is concerned when he said in the wake of its financial meltdown, and I quote, "Korea is now owned and operated by our treasury. That's the positive side of this crisis." After high-level consultations with the world's largest commercial and merchant banks, the U.S. Treasury insisted that the IMF bailout agreement lift the ceiling on foreign ownership of Korean corporate predators, lift the ceiling on foreign ownership of Korean industrial assets to 55% and allow 100% ownership, foreign ownership of Korean banks. Foreign corporate predators, that's where it comes in, moved in for the kill. buying up Korean industrial assets at bargain basement prices. Although there was a massive financial flight from South Korea by speculators, some creditors decided to stay behind and take advantage of the crisis by rolling over their loans. But instead of lending at the rate that they had before the crisis of 0.25 percentage points above the London interbank offered rate, they charged a full 6 percentage points above that standard rate, thereby reaping huge windfall profits. In effect, the bailout filled the pockets of the global financial managers but failed to rescue Korean firms, as 200 companies were shut down on a daily basis and 4,000 workers each day were driven out into the streets of the unemployed during the height of the crisis. The damage in Korea is the damage felt all over. We've heard it from Yao, we've heard it from others throughout this day. And whether we're talking about the financial crisis and the bailout packages in Mexico and Thailand and Indonesia or South Korea, in Russia, Brazil, and even in Japan recently, the pattern is pretty well the same. Pillage of the central banks, structural adjustment programs, foreign buyouts and takeovers, massive unemployment, and forced bankruptcies. In effect, what we have here is this huge financial safety net. What the Wall Street Treasury complex does is to provide this safety net in such a way that it provides an ongoing insurance plan for speculative capitalism. Bailing out foreign investors who have delivered speculative assaults on various countries with public funds acts as a perverse incentive for the same investors to take even greater risks. And this is the so-called moral hazard. Speculators will, in fact, take more chances knowing that they will be bailed out again and again and again. So this is the engine, to a large extent, of speculative capitalism and of the global financial casino. But so far, we've just been talking about the post-crisis safety nets. In recent months and year, in the last couple of years, what has happened is that plans have been introduced now to introduce a pre-crisis safety net. It's not enough you have a post-crisis safety net. Now you want to help the investment houses and banks out with a pre-crisis safety net. How did this happen? Well, on October 30th, 1998, the Clinton administration went before the IMF and proposed and outlined a plan for a $90 billion enhanced IMF facility to offer contingent short-term credit for countries pursuing strong IMF-approved policies on the one hand before a crisis occurs and an emergency bailout becomes necessary. Instead of bringing about precautionary measures to deter that this turbulence and the financial turbulence is dealt with, what happens is that an existence of a fund is put in place which in many ways entices speculators to pursue in their deadly raids on national currencies. So this brings us back to the strategic question. What are we going to do about this? And how can we, in fact, start to recognize that it's really in seven countries, the G7 countries, that the real engine is in place? It's here in terms of the U.S. and the U.S. Treasury and Wall Street, but it's also present with those other G7 countries and their central banks. And I think in many ways we have to kind of ask ourselves, just like during the nuclear arms race, do we not need to really think seriously now about a suffocation strategy, a strategy that is designed to cut the lifeline and to cut the oxygen out of this? The oxygen we're talking about are public funds. But the fact is there is no raging public debate in any of the G7 countries about the fact that these public funds are being used to fuel this global financial casino. So I think instead, and in addition to all of the alternatives that were outlined before, whether we're talking about capital controls on capital,
whether we're talking about revitalizing the central banks or erasing the debt or bringing in the Tobin tax or redirecting public investment, private investment for public purposes, or bringing about worker control over pension funds, or a whole series of things. We've also got to make sure that we focus our energies on the real target, and in many ways, the real target is the Wall Street Treasury complex. Let's put the choke chain around it, and let's make sure that the youth blockades that are forming around the IMF and the World Bank in the next few days, that the spirit and the drive and the courage of the youth in those blockades is transformed into a suffocation strategy country by country in each of the G7 countries over the next few years.
Speaker on this panel is the only one amongst who's been arrested in front of the World Bank and IMF wearing a Kermit the Frog suit. he did this. He did this in 1985 in the waning days of the Marcos dictatorship in his native country, the Philippines. Walden Bella was a leading activist against dictatorship in the Philippines. 15 years later, I'll simply note, on November 30th, 1999, when I was walking down the street with about 40,000 other people in Seattle, I ducked into a hotel to make a phone call, and up on the television screen, which was running the demonstration continuously, there was a policeman grabbing and fairly brutally dragging someone across the street, and the person was in characteristic fashion, fighting back, and it was Walden Bello. when he's not demonstrating, he's written some of the most terrific analyses of globalization. He wrote the first major critique of the World Bank, a book called Development Debacle. He picked the Asian crisis 10 years before it happened in a book called Dragons in Distress. He's now the executive director of Focus on the Global South in Bangkok, Thailand. Please welcome Walden Bello.